Good afternoon, and welcome to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy, joined today by my co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. Crime in South Central, car thefts, break-ins, and property theft, has been a topic of much conversation among Alaskans for the last few years. It is shaping up as a key plank in the state's upcoming governor and legislative elections. Alaska also has the challenge of rural safety issues, where police officers are not at the ready often to defend citizens. Within this volatile mix sits Alaska's own self-defense statutes and the state's 2013 passage of a Stand Your Ground law. Given the continuing controversy over applying Stand Your Ground to two Florida cases, Trayvon Martin in 2012 and just last month to a shooting outside a convenience store, it seemed prudent to review Alaska's rules and work to make it very clear to citizens just where the lines are in self-defense and Stand Your Ground. Our two experts today, and I'll let Judge Elaine Andrews introduce them in just a moment, both say that to understand Stand Your Ground, you really need to understand Alaska's self-defense laws, where use of deadly and non-deadly force is spelled out. A loose reading of these and Stand Your Ground could get a citizen into serious trouble if misunderstood. So that's where we're going. We've got links on our website to the statutes and also to news articles around this issue. Find them by selecting the radio tab on our homepage, alaskapublic.org, and scrolling to Hometown Alaska to open the webpage introducing today's program. Your comments and questions are welcome throughout the show, and I'll repeat these numbers several times during the hour. But if you're in Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8433. Statewide, the number is 1-888-353-5752, and we can take your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And now I'm going to introduce co-host Elaine Andrews, and she'll introduce our guests.
Thank you, Kathleen. I am delighted to have two highly experienced attorneys here in the studio with me. John Cashin is a lawyer in private practice, formerly a public defender. He has a depth of trial experience and a lot of it in rural Alaska. Thanks so much, John, for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And James Fayette, a longtime prosecutor, also a highly experienced trial attorney. And both John and James have had extensive trial experience, and if you are a lawyer doing criminal prosecution or criminal defense, there's no question, but at some point in your career, you're going to come across the complexities of self-defense and in more recent times, how that dovetails with Stand Your Ground aspects of the self-defense law. So as Kathleen suggested, this is actually a pretty complex topic. People think they know what self-defense means, and everyone has their own definition in their head. And we're going to try and kind of tease out the important things about self-defense and either confirm with citizens that their notion was correct or let them understand that maybe they had a misunderstanding of self-defense and what it means. So let me just get the ball rolling by... maybe I'll start with John and just ask him. We've got self-defense, and there's self-defense with deadly force and self-defense with non-deadly force. So we actually have two statutes that talk about self-defense. Can you give us a little insight into what that's about?
Sure, and I'm sure Jay can build on this. The I mean, deadly force, I think, in simplest terms, means what it says. When you get into a situation where you have... A shooting and an actual death, or you know, some mechanism of getting to a death, but it's statutorily defined what deadly force is, and there are certainly cases where you have to engage in that. But we have very different standards, I would say, when it comes to the use of non-deadly force and the use of deadly force in the state of Alaska. And part of my hope, you know, for today, I think we alluded to it a little bit in the introduction, is that we can take a bit of a helicopter view and put out the word that self-defense is, I think, not quite as broad as many people maybe would believe. And I hope as we're fielding questions, we dive into that issue a little bit as we go forward here. But I'd defer to Jay if you want to follow up with him on that question as well.
I agree with John. There's, for those people that are looking at the website, probably the place to begin is to take a look at Alaska's two self-defense statutes, subsection 330 and subsection 335. And Kathleen said that they're on the website. And a quick way to talk about that is the first statute is the Alaska's basic statute governing self-defense that says when you can use force to defend yourself. And the bottom line is you can use force when it's reasonably necessary to defend yourself against unlawful force against you, unless you are the initial aggressor or it's mutual combat or you provoked the violence. That's the first rule. The second rule is Alaska statute on use of deadly force. A person can use deadly force when it's reasonably necessary to defend themselves against robbery, death, serious physical injury. And then when we get into stand your ground, there's important disqualifiers when you can't use deadly force, and the law requires or used to require that you retreat. And so you used to have to retreat unless you were a peace officer or you were defending your own home. But in 2013, our legislature then wrote an exception that basically swallows the rule. And for those looking at the statute, you can see the fifth subsection there that says, now you don't have a duty to retreat if you're in a place where you have a right to be.
Which could be a parking lot.
That's right.
Yeah.
And what's the next point I want to make is that the concepts that I'm talking about here govern public place shootings or stabbings. Alaska law has always said that citizens don't have a duty to retreat from their home. That's a different statute.
It's a castle? Is it called a
That's right.
Like your home is your castle sort of thing?
That's right. You've always been able to use deadly force to terminate a burglary in an occupied dwelling. So that's been Alaska law for 40 years. The 2013 legislature didn't change that result at all. So what we're talking about here are parking lots, sidewalks, road rage cases, convenience store cases, as we see from Florida. So that's what we're talking about here.
I have a caller.
Okay.
So let's get hi, Scott. You're on Justice Alaska, and you've got a question about warning shots and deadly force.
I do, and this has always been a question that I have had a hard time trying to figure out. Number one, I don't generally carry a firearm with me. I am a firearm enthusiast, so I.
Oh. We lost you, Scott. If you can hear us, we just lost you.
So maybe.
Oh, yeah, there he is.
There he is. Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. Let me get to my question real quick.
Okay.
It's my understanding that you can use deadly force, fire your firearm in self-defense if you believe that you are in immediate harm of being seriously injured or killed. My question is, if you feel that it is safe enough to fire a warning shot to warn off the aggressor, is that not also saying you did not feel that you were in immediate danger? And I will listen to my answer off the air. Also, that if you weren't in immediate danger, would that firing of the firearm as a warning shot, would that be a misconduct, firing a firearm dangerously? Could you be charged with reckless discharge of a firearm?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. We shall see what our experts have to say about it. Who wants to jump in?
John's pointing his finger at me. The gentleman asks three questions. Is firing a warning shot deadly force? The answer is yes, it is, because Alaska statutes say that deadly force includes placing someone in fear of imminent physical injury with a dangerous instrument. So the question would be governed by the same principles. He also says it's his understanding that he can use deadly force to defend himself against death or serious physical injury. Yes, he's correct. That's right. The next question is, whether warning shots.
Whether the warning shot, because you're doing a warning shot, does that mean you're not in?
That you're really
you're not in imminent danger, because at least you thought you could
scare them away
with a warning shot.
Well, that's a hard one. I'd need to know more information because I could see the argument. But the problem with these, when we start arguing about hypotheticals, is that you can always add more facts in and you can can play that game for hours and hours. What if it was dark? What words were spoken? How far away were the opponents? So I need more information. The next question is whether or not warning shots are a good idea or not. And that's not really a legal question. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a question for a personal safety or a gun safety expert. And I'm not one of those. I can tell you how this would play out in court. The danger, of course, is that warning shots now increase the possibility that somebody else might intervene and now there might be a gunfight. So that's about as far as I can go with my answer to that.
Yeah, I think really one of the things that I think guides our conversation in this, and we met before the show, and we kept coming back to this, that there's so much complexity to the law and the circumstances. The law is the law, but the trials are about the facts applied to the law, and it's fact dependent as to whether or not. It's a crime or you have a defense. And so these are, I would agree they're difficult. I think we should try and tease out as much as we can to inform the public about some of the things that we know. And obviously, Jay has indicated to this caller, he has the definition, right? You have to be in imminent danger of serious...
Imminent, yeah.
Imminent danger of serious physical injury. You can't just be mad mm-hmm. or
That's
upset.
Right.
Yes,
mm-hmm,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So...
If I could just build on that.
Jump in, John.
I mean, the one thing I think Jay's correct that the firing of the warning shot falls into the use of deadly force. I would say, I don't know if it would be always, but I think in most circumstances it's going to fit right in there. And maybe an example to illuminate that a little bit more would be, what about the firing of a warning shot when you see someone stealing a valuable piece of property from your front yard? And I think that most listeners would assume, yeah, we can go there. Warning shot is actually exercise of caution. And I think our laws are to the contrary on that. And as we get deeper into, the use of deadly force, and as we talked about it being in response to imminent death, serious physical injury, there's nothing in the statute built in to prevent a property crime occurring on your yard, for example. Robbery is built into the statute, but I think that the use of deadly force in and of itself is such a substantial step, and many people underestimate what needs to be in place before you go there.
The thing I was thinking about from the meeting we had earlier is that you will be second-guessed in your decision by prosecutors and defense attorneys. And just because, when I looked back at how the legislature responded back in 2013 when we passed mm-hmm. this, John Coghill was in favor of it and said something like, this is to make sure the law's on the side of citizens, because a lot of things can happen fast and a citizen has to be able to, I'm paraphrasing. And Gutenberg, also from Fairbanks, a Democrat, said, this just goes way too far. People will go on the offensive. And so those are the two sides of this thing. Like, you do want people to be able to protect themselves, but if the gun handler is unaware of what the limits are, you're in really tricky territory. And that's really why we have this show, to try to explain to people. We're not pro or con one way or the other. It's just sort of know what you're up against if you decide to fire a weapon. And on our website, we've got a piece by Val von Brocklin that ran in the Anchorage Daily News that tried to lay this out, and also a recent Q&A with James Fayette and KTUU that also takes some of these typical questions that listeners might have about it. So you could just get yourself in a whole lot of trouble, know. And just the way, because you felt endangered at that moment, lots of people are going to go through all the facts of that case and try to see if there is a case for you or a case against you, right?
That's right.
Well, let me ask our trial attorneys here, following up on Kathleen's question. When you say, I felt in danger, there is the... there's an objective and a subjective piece to this. So, and maybe we're already getting into the weeds on this, but let's talk about, the typical response of someone who has now discharged a weapon, used deadly force, maybe killed somebody, maybe didn't, and said, I really felt like I was in imminent danger of serious physical injury. Is that good enough, just that answer, or is there some other standard that it gets weighed against?
I know the answer to that question. The answer is no. Because if that's all that were ever required, nobody'd ever get convicted, right? Because someone could say, I thought I saw a gun and I was afraid, and that would end the question, and that's not the law. The law uses the catchphrase, reasonably believe, and it uses it several times. And if you read the two statutes we put on the website, it repeats that phrase three times, twice in the basic self-defense statute, and then a third time in the subsection 335, the deadly force statute. And so believe is what you just said, Judge Andrews, the subjective, what lawyers call the subjective prong. What did the person think was necessary to defend themselves? But then we go to the next question, what was reasonable? And we put a reasonable person in the shoes of the person who used force. And we say, would a reasonable person have made the same choice? And a reasonable person is someone who is, first of all, sober or not under the influence of drugs, because I'm a street crime prosecutor. You know, a high percentage of cases, somebody used force when they were drinking or under the influence of street drugs. So the jury is told you have to evaluate what this person did from the viewpoint of a reasonable person. And so the law builds in sort of an objective review of what happened. And that's, of course, you can anticipate, that's a classic prosecutor's argument, which is what happened here was excessive, it wasn't reasonable. And ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you should disbelieve Mr. Cashin's self-defense argument for that reason.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to just throw in, if you're just joining us, we're talking about Alaska self-defense laws and stand your ground, which Alaska has in its statutes. And if you want to participate in this conversation, give us a call at 550-8433, 1-888-353-5752, statewide. Or you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And in the studio today discussing this, we have Judge Elaine Andrews, the co-host of our show, and James Fayette, a prosecutor, and John Cashin, former public defender, now in private practice. So just wanted to, if you're just joining us, that's why we're having this serious conversation.
Well, let me ask John, in self-defense cases that you've tried, what are the issues that tend to bring people, what are the defenses that are the most typical kinds of defenses you see in a self-defense case? What are some of the facts that you've seen repeated? Especially in connection with your rural Alaska service, I'd be kind of interested in that.
Mm. I think it's first important to understand that most self-defense cases play out under the spectrum of use of non-deadly force. So, you know, the examples that you can think of are very easy. You're in a bar and a person raises his fist to you and you believe that you are about to be punched and you react accordingly with the use of force. But the bar component is, you know, as Jay has already alluded to here, creates a wrinkle in the real world because there is both the subjective and the objective component as to reasonably believing that you need to use either non-deadly force or deadly force, and alcohol is a complication in that. But I think that the most common fact pattern from a defense lawyer is on a much simpler level of almost a hand-to-hand situation where you really have to very precisely go through with the client their subjective, you know, their perception of what was happening in that moment in time, being able to really break it down slowly because every detail matters in a moment in time like that. I mean, things that might seem like minutiae in normal conversation become huge issues in self-defense trials. And the prosecution has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that a person did not act in self-defense, that their actions weren't justified. So I think there's a... most of it is scenarios that we've seen play out around us. I think as this show progresses, we'll get more into the deadly force scenario, which is far more limited than use of non-deadly force. But if a person reasonably believes that they're about to be injured and they react with the use of force to defend themselves, they're entitled to do so, and that's a very common fact pattern in terms of a day-to-day trial issue.
So can I jump in on two things
sure.
John just said? So I appreciate what John, I agree with what John says, and he also makes a point that people ought to think about. People often say that someone got convicted because they didn't prove their self-defense case in court, and they say it that way, and that's incorrect, actually. The burden, as John just pointed out, under Alaska law, the burden is on the prosecutor to prove that it's not self-defense. In other words, the burden is upon the prosecutor to disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt to the unanimous satisfaction of 12 people in the jury box. That's hard. It's like proving a negative proposition. It's supposed to be hard. The system's set up to ensure that a person who's innocent doesn't get convicted. That's supposed to be hard to convict people of crimes. Having said that, it's very difficult as a prosecutor to convince people, you know, that this is not self-defense. And another thing that John's experience, is many of his cases are rural cases where there's a higher percentage of acquaintance assaults. In other words, the opponent, the defendant and the opponent know each other, which is, this might get too far into the weeds, but it opens up discussion of why self-defense is such a powerful tool for a criminal defender. It's because when the self-defense claim is made, the defense lawyer gets to say, look, here's all the things about the opponent that my client knew. Here's all the dangerous things that person did that my client knew. And they get to talk about that in front of the jury. In other words, my opponent was a dangerous person. Let me tell you about all the – and they get to do that.
And that's to show that they had a subjectively reasonable fear. In other words, their fear was –
yes.
Was reasonable in their own mind because of what they knew.
Correct.
Okay.
Which, and if it's homicide litigation, the victim's not around to say, that's all malarkey, that's not true. He's not going to testify. It's a homicide case. So that's why it's a powerful defense tool. And the result here, if it's self-defense, is not guilty. It's not like the jury says, well, it's kind of like self-defense. We'll convict of something lesser. It's not that. Self-defense is a total defense to all crimes involving use of force. So it's a very powerful defense tool.
So we need to take a tiny break here. You are listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Back listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm here with my co-host, Judge Elaine Andrews. We're talking about self-defense laws in Alaska. And of course, across the nation, it's a hot topic. We've been watching Florida. But Alaska's not the same as Florida. That's something we'll probably talk about in this segment. So you can't judge Alaska's law by what you're reading in the papers about Florida's law. We have James Fayette, a prosecutor, in the studio with us, and John Cashin, a former public defender who worked in Bethel and is now in Anchorage and now in private practice. And we do have callers coming in and emails. I'm going to go ahead and go with one email here right now, and then we'll get back to discussing this. I've got an email from Justina who says, Alaska's Stand Your Ground law is a threat to public safety. This dangerous law allows a person to shoot to kill in public, even when there is a clear and safe alternative. States with Stand Your Ground laws like Alaska's see increases in homicide rates, and these laws also have been shown to have a disproportionate effect on communities of color. Additionally, evidence indicates Stand Your Ground laws don't actually deter crime. There's a lot packed into that. I know one of the things we talked about before the show was whether the data is in yet and the studies are in yet that show crime, the effect of Stand Your Ground laws, whether crime increases, homicides increase, and it's, it seems from our look at it that it's not clear yet.
Right. I think we were looking for longitudinal studies that could be relied on, and I didn't see anything that I thought was worthy of quoting with any level of confidence.
Right.
So I'd be reluctant
to just go ahead and state it as fact.
Yes.
Yeah. And I did find a study. ICERD has been involved in a study, but it's still out for review. And I mean, I just don't know the answer to that. So, but I guess people do have opinions, and the idea that Alaska Stand Your Ground is a threat to public safety, maybe that's something we can talk about. What do you think?
Sure. I'll take the first stab at this. I think it's interesting. I know that, or I suspect that Jay is in many ways in agreement with some of the comments on the significance of Stand Your Ground legislation in Alaska. I think from the defense bar that it was not really viewed as particularly significant litigation. And just to speak to that quickly, you know, the first half of the justification statute on use of deadly force sets out the situations in which you can use deadly force. So you believe that you're about to be seriously injured. You believe that you're about to be killed. There's a robbery in progress. There's a sexual assault in progress. And none of that has changed or affected by Stand Your Ground. And I think sometimes when people hear Stand Your Ground, they assume that imminence factor, that fear of a real-world danger, has somehow evaporated if your ego is on the line or if your pride is on the line. What changes with what we're calling Stand Your Ground and what became subsection B5 of that statute is that you don't have a duty to leave the area in any place where you have a right to be. So I think, you know, as a defense lawyer, when I think about that statute, I always view it as it's going to be very few cases that are really going to be impacted by that or the face of those cases changed tremendously. And again, I think that people have a real misconception that with Stand Your Ground legislation, that the use of deadly force becomes allowed in far broader circumstances than is reality.
Can I just ask a question just from a layman's point of view? When I looked at the statute, I see that duty to retreat is still in the deadly force statute, right? And really, we don't have a separate Stand Your Ground law. They just, as you just said, John, they tacked Subsection 5, which has the, you know, you have a right to be language in it. And so are those two things in conflict for the average person?
Well, I just think they create confusion. I don't disagree with the notion that the face of many prosecutions could be changed by that subsection 5. But to my mind, it's this second component, and people lose sight of the threshold component of you still have to be in fear of imminent death.
Yeah.
It's not that you're in fear of imminent humiliation or imminent my ego just got thrown to the wayside. I mean, none of that. So Stand Your Ground seems to me there's a sort of machismo notion that comes across that I have a far broader right to use deadly force than existed before. And I don't see it that way at all. I would strongly disagree with someone saying that Stand Your Ground broadens the circumstances in which a person can use deadly force.
Okay. I'm going to take a caller, unless you want to jump in, James. Do you have anything to add there?
There's quite a bit I could say, but maybe...
Oh,
but
okay.
Sure. I mean, I think that... Again, speaking speaking as the attorney that's got the burden of proof to disprove self-defense, the subsection 5, the elimination of the duty to retreat, actually took away a classic prosecutor's argument. So, in other words, if I can unpack what a prosecutor's closing argument would have sounded like 5 or 6 years ago and what it would sound like now. The quick version is like this. A prosecutor would argue, ladies and gentlemen, this isn't self-defense because you should conclude based on the evidence that we've heard in this case that the defendant started it. He was what the law calls the first aggressor. But if you don't believe that or if you're not satisfied with that, you should say that this is mutual combat. And then I would review the evidence to say it's mutual combat. Because if either of those apply, the defendant can't claim self-defense. Or another alternative would be that you should conclude that this was excessive force. Mr. Cashin's client was afraid at worst of being pushed down and punched. He wasn't afraid of being killed. The opponent had no weapon. So this was excessive force. He responded with a headshot, a fatal shot. And lastly, you should, if you're not persuaded by those three alternatives, you should conclude that Mr. Cashin's client could have walked away. He could have walked away, put his pride in his back pocket, and you don't have to be unanimous on why self-defense doesn't apply to this case. Several of you can think the first alternative, several others can think the second, and so on and so on. As long as all 12 of you agree that I've disproven self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt, that's a guilty verdict. That's what a closing argument would have sounded like 5 or 6 years ago. It would still sound the same, except for that last component. It's taken away that alternative. I can't argue that the defendant could have avoided it by walking away. Now, where is this relevant? Road rage shootings, where someone says, I thought somebody had a gun, they cut me off of traffic, they flipped me off, and then it's a road rage shooting. Bar break cases, where people are chipping teeth in the parking lot of your favorite neighborhood bar. That's where that came into play. So that's important. That's I'll do for now, I guess.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and take our caller. I'd like to welcome Cody onto Justice Alaska. Hi, Cody.
Hey, how's it going?
Thanks for waiting. You've been on there for a while. Appreciate it.
That's all right. I had a question. You mentioned that being an aggressor will sort of disqualify or negate the self-defense. I wanted to know how that applies to Samaritans or passerby who sees something going on and try to jump in to help someone else who is in danger. And I can take my question off air.
Okay, thanks, Cody. All right. Well, what do you think, guys? Not sure.
So there's a statute that covers that. It's defense of third persons.
Okay.
You can protect a third person to the extent the person you're defending could have used defense force to defend themselves, if that's clear. You sort of stand in the shoes of the person that you're defending based upon the circumstances as they appear to you. You stand in the shoes of the person you're defending, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
If that person could have used force, you're entitled to use force to the same extent they could.
Okay. Yes. Even if it involves a deadly weapon.
Yes.
Yes. Same thing. Exactly.
Right. But you have to. Sure. But.
But you have to feel that you were in imminent danger of being shot yourself, or.
Correct. Or defending someone who was in that circumstance.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
That's actually, if I'm not mistaken, 1181.340, defense of third persons. So the very next statute in the book, for those of you that want to look it up, it says what I just said.
Okay. All right. I'm going to take another call, and then we've got a couple emails coming in. So I'd like to welcome Mike onto Justice Alaska. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, and thanks for holding there for a little while. What's your question?
I had a comment and two questions. The one that you just mentioned about defending a third person and what that provision is. I would caution the caller who asked that, though, and others, that you better be darn sure you know what the situation is before you jump in with deadly force.
Right.
On something like that. You may have some plainclothes officers
trying to
take somebody down, and you don't understand the situation.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, that's my comment.
Yeah.
My question, earlier on in the program, you mentioned about the Stand Your Ground law, and, you know, it was just passed a few years ago. And mentioned that, you know, you now don't have a duty to retreat. However, I believe, if I'm not incorrect, that even before that Stand Your Ground law was passed, you did not have a duty to retreat unless you could do so safely. And that was the part I didn't catch or hear there. The second question, and then I'll get off the line and take your response. In a personal defense shooting situation, what is your advice for the person who's doing the shooting there, defending them life and property there, or defending them lives, rather, about giving a statement when the police arrive, rather than waiting for time to compose themselves and having time to speak with an attorney? And I can take my response offline. Thank you very much.
Somehow I think that the people at this table are going to have two different responses on that second question.
I can take the low-hanging fruit if you want. I do firmly believe the truth of you should never talk to the police when you're being questioned in a circumstance.
No matter what the situation.
No matter what the circumstance, 100% factually innocent. I think the best advice is always take the time to talk to an attorney, understand the importance and the power of the right to remain silent. And I don't hesitate on that aspect of that. The first part of the question relating to the duty to retreat, it is correct that, you know, the statute has woven into it duty to retreat with complete safety to the others being defended. So that aspect of the question is right. And I think, you know, hearkening back to my original response on the stand your ground, there were previously four delineated circumstances where the, if we call it the duty to retreat, was articulated or particularized, I suppose, that you were on premises in a building where you work, you were protecting a child or a member of the household, and then it became dramatically broadened with the addition of subsection 5, saying any other place where a person has a right to be. So that's my initial response.
Okay. How about you, Jay?
This gentleman makes excellent points. He's right. When you jump in and defend somebody else, particularly when you're doing it with deadly force, you're standing in the shoes of the person that you think you're defending. And it's a pretty solemn thing to jump in with deadly force, and you could be wrong, as the gentleman
points
out.
That's a scary thought.
It is.
Scary thought.
And yeah. So I agree with his point that you better be sure of what you're doing. The second thing, he's absolutely right. The duty to retreat always said if you could do so with complete safety to yourself and as to others. So it was actually a fairly modest requirement, but now it's been essentially eliminated by adding subsection 5, which is an exception that pretty much swallows the rule. The only people now that have a duty to retreat basically are trespassers. So, and as to whether or not people should speak with the police, I think people should tell the truth. And so that's my opinion. I think the police are trying to figure out what happened, and oftentimes their task is made much more complex by people outright deceiving them, lying. And so I think people should tell the truth to the police. Mm-hmm. But John makes a good point. People certainly have the right to remain silent. And oftentimes are well advised to speak to an attorney. Mm-hmm. So,
how about I go to a question here on the email? What is the difference between robbery, which you can use deadly force, and theft? Also, the email link. Oh my goodness! I'll have to fix some link. Someone's telling me we have a bad link, so I'll fix that. But the question is, what is the difference between robbery, which you can use deadly force, and theft?
And okay. I think this is actually a critical question, because I think this is the one where people really are going to get themselves in trouble. So this is one to pay attention to.
With that set up. So the difference is robbery combines a theft or an attempted theft with a personal assault. So if I shoplift something from the grocery store or the department store, that's a theft, that's a shoplift. And I get halfway out into the parking lot, and the security guy says, come with me, and I turn and I pull my knife, and I say, get away, now I've robbed him. So a robbery is requires a personal threat to the opponent to try to get away with property. So you can use deadly force to protect to defend yourself against a robbery. You can't use deadly force to protect your property. If all we're talking about is someone stealing property, we're breaking into a unoccupied storage shed, or the question that we get all the time is, can you shoot people? If you're in your house and you see someone stealing your car out in the alley, can you shoot them? No, you can't, because there's no personal threat. I actually had someone ask me, a citizen asked me a few years ago, well, what about trap guns? What about spring guns to defend a remote cabin that's...
Oh, something that's going to go off auto.
That's right. That's
right. If the door's opened, the gun goes off?
Right. And okay. and the answer is no.
You can't
use deadly force just to protect property. As frustrating as that might be to the property owner, life's more valuable than that. And so that's the difference between a theft and a robbery.
All right. You know, we have to take another break, guys. So you're listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
We're back with Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and I'm here with co-host Judge Elaine Andrews, and we have two attorneys in our office, or in our studio. We have James Fayette, a prosecutor in the Anchorage District Attorney's Office, and John Cashin, a former public defender, now in private practice in Anchorage, with rural experience as a public defender, which is a big deal in Alaska. We have folks hanging in both the email and the phone category, and I'm going to throw out our numbers one more time, and probably the last time for this show, 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 statewide, and again, email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And those of you who are hanging on there, we're going to get to you as soon as we can. So let's go to Carl. You're calling Justice Alaska. Hi, Carl.
Hi. Before we had Stand Your Ground and these modifications, I understand the standard was called the reasonable man standard. Is that, am I correct on that?
There's still
yes.
Okay. Isn't there still a reasonable
man?
It's still there.
Oh, it is. Okay, because standing your ground doesn't sound like a very reasonable man standard to me, unless you're like gun-toting crazy. But with that in mind, had the reasonable man standard, meaning not the stand your ground standard, been in effect, say, in Florida, when George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin, would that have changed the outcome of George Zimmerman's case?
Oh, boy. This gets into Florida versus Alaska, which we're maybe not equipped to deal with, honestly.
But the standard is the same, right? Isn't our law very much modeled after Florida's?
I don't know.
I don't know if I'd go so far as to say it's modeled after. The Florida law has provisions that our law doesn't have, a pretrial immunity hearing, that type of thing. And I'm no expert in Florida law. But in the Martin case, the Zimmerman case that you just talked about, that's a public place shooting and
go ahead. He's just going to take it off the air.
Okay. Yeah. So the gentleman was acquitted. But I'll go back to what I said earlier. The prosecutor's argument before in Alaska, before 2013, would have been all those things I said before. This force was excessive. He was the initial aggressor. But if you don't believe that, ladies and gentlemen, he could have avoided the necessity of using deadly force by simply walking away, or in that case, I suppose, staying in his vehicle and not getting out or driving away. That would be the argument. After 2013 enactment of the abrogation of the duty to retreat, a prosecutor couldn't say that last part of the argument anymore, and maybe the case turned on that point. It's always hard to say whether or not an outcome in court turns on one specific point, because mm-hmm. it almost never does. Mm-hmm. It's a combination of things.
Yeah, I think really where the hang-up is here is people hear that phrase, stand your ground, and they think it changes self-defense, and it doesn't, in terms of you have to be in imminent fear of serious physical injury or to stop a robbery, to stop a sexual assault, before you can use deadly force. And it doesn't change that. And your belief in that has to be both, you have to actually really believe it yourself, and that That belief needs to be what a reasonable person in that situation would believe. So, I am concerned that you know, throwing around the loose language, people think that it's really broadened the right. It hasn't broadened the right to use deadly force. It simply means you don't have to retreat, but you still have to have all of that fear of imminent serious physical injury. I mean, I guess the one thing I probably, because we have a lot of callers and a lot of questions, if you go to the website, which I have to say I don't always do, but I did this time, I reread the article that I had read when it was published that Val Van Brocklin wrote. So if at the end of the program you're left with questions, that's a really good primer.
Pretty
straightforward, and you know, lots more there if you really want to delve into the subject. But hers really is a very good sort of citizen guide on why it's important to know what you're doing here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to take a few more questions here by email. And some of these we may have answered because people are in their cars jumping in and out. And so you may find yourself answering when you already talked about. So here we go. If I look in my driveway and I see a stranger breaking into my car, what can I do? Warning shot? Aim to kill if the warning shot doesn't cause their departure from my driveway? Can I shoot them then? What can I do if someone pushes me aside while I'm at... Oh, this is a different question. So second question is, what if if someone pushes me aside while I'm at the gas pump and tries to steal my car? So let's take the first one. We have kind of answered that first one. The answer is no. When property is being stolen from your driveway, you cannot shoot.
Well, the first question was, what can I do? And my answer would be, call the police. And I agree. No, you can't. There's no personal threat in the first.
Right. No imminent personal threat to
that's
you.
Right. So, yeah. That's right.
And maybe important to articulate there that it's just not woven into defense of property, because we do have a justification statute, you know, related to defense of property, but it relates to the home, and it's far narrower than what has just been described there. But I absolutely agree with the answer of what you can do there is you can call the police, and I know that's, you know, a source of big frustration of, well, I'm not going to hear from the police for quite a while in the wake of that call, but that's the correct answer.
And his idea of a warning shot, and if he still doesn't leave, then can I shoot him? No.
No.
Okay,
I mean, the warning shot is arguably use of deadly force, and the particulars are going to matter on that, I believe. But
okay. And how about that last one? What can I do if someone pushes me aside while I'm at the gas pump and tries to steal my car?
So that's a robbery. So the hyper-technical answer is that it changes, because that's a robbery, and the law does allow use of deadly force to defend against a robbery. Whether or not all-out, fatal, deadly force is excessive or not under those circumstances would be something that would be reviewed. Mm-hmm. But at first blush, the first part of the answer is, can you use deadly force to defend against robbery? The answer is yes, you can. Whether or not that's reasonably necessary, you know, how big are these people? Is it night? What words are spoken? What does the security video show or not show? What do the other witnesses say? Those are the variables that would go into a review of the case.
Right. When we were meeting beforehand, and I said, well, let's run some scenarios, and James' first answer is, well, My answer to your scenario is, well, I need more facts to sort of run it down for you. And that's kind of what we're finding here. I have another one, which is, what can I do if I see a stranger loading my lawnmower into their truck? Again, it's a property crime, right? And you're not in any imminent danger yourself personally. So it would be a bad idea to...
It would be against the law.
Yeah. Not only a bad idea, but actually illegal. Let me see. We've got, if APD or AST officer is involved in a shooting, when do they make a statement? Mm-hmm. How long after the shooting? Do they have a representative of a police union or a lawyer before making a statement? If highly trained police AST do not make statements immediately, why should individuals involved in a deadly force situation be treated any differently? They say good show and great topic. So how about some of that? What do you think?
I think we discussed a little bit preliminarily. I do think use of deadly force by police officers is the subject of an entirely separate radio show. And frankly, you could easily occupy an hour on
right,
that topic.
Right, right. I remember when we met earlier, we
So let's put that on for a future show,
yeah.
Kathleen, and let's because the rules are different.
Yeah. Well, they are, yeah. Can I get two
sure,
sentences
sure.
to answer that?
Absolutely.
Police
sure.
work is one of the most highly documented endeavors that you can possibly imagine. The police officer in an ongoing officer-involved situation probably has made numerous statements on his police radio to the next officer that was standing next to him when the police call was made, to the first sergeant so who arrives on scene. What the question is asking is, when do they sit down and make a formal statement? And it might be later, and and do they have union representation or the opportunity to talk to a lawyer? That varies from department to department. And John's right, that is a subject for a different day. But it would be misleading to say that an officer involved in a fatal confrontation doesn't make any statements at all until days and days later. That would be misleading and mm-hmm. unfair mm-hmm. because they probably said exactly what happened on the police radio, which is recorded, and to their colleagues who arrive on scene shortly thereafter, and so forth. So that was more than two sentences. But
that's okay. This is one, again, that we may have touched on. The police need enough information to determine to make an arrest or not. Given this, I don't think not saying anything is an option. This is an opinion. What should or should not be said to responding officers given a self-defense shooting? Again, you were sort of...
Yeah, I really would. I think it's such an important message to get out that if you are suspected of having committed a crime, it is in your best interest not to make a statement. And I don't disagree with anything that Jay said as to, you know, the notion of tell the truth. I'm just saying exercise your right to remain silent, protect yourself, share that advice with your loved ones, and understand the significance and the power of the right to remain silent. And mm-hmm. it gives you an opportunity to intelligently confer with someone and to receive advice, because you can always go back to the well and make that statement if you'd like to.
Mm-hmm. So I don't disagree with, I'd say it a little bit differently. I'll say it this way. What do you say to the police if you're going to say anything? The truth, because oftentimes the prosecutor's most compelling argument is that someone lied to the police, and the first story to the police was, I don't know what this is all about, man, you're the police, you figure it out, I wasn't even there. And then they come to court later and say self-defense, and the prosecutor's going to say that the lie to the police at the police station or on scene is strong, what lawyers call strong circumstantial evidence of subjective consciousness of guilt. When Mr. Cashin says self-defense, that actually, ladies and gentlemen, was the second defense. The first defense was, I didn't do it, you figure it out. And that oftentimes is a devastating prosecutor's argument. So if you're going to say anything, don't lie. And John, do you agree with me on that one?
Absolutely. I mean,
don't
I think
lie.
That illustrates the point of what I'm saying, because it's in the heat of the moment, it's very easy to just
make a mistake.
Not say it the way you
mm-hmm.
should.
Yeah, wait. So. With upon reflection, you would say it. I'm going to take a call from Daniel in Anchorage, and you want to ask about how it applies to the road. Are you talking about road rage, Daniel?
Yeah, I would guess you'd say that the guy that tried to run me off the road was probably pretty angry. I was recently on my way from Anchorage to Wasilla, and we were in a construction zone. The traffic was really tight. A car came up behind me, tailgated me for a few miles, then got beside me and actually tried to run me off the road. And I didn't brake or I didn't yield my position, and he actually ran into the front of my car. Now, would that be considered a scenario where you could use deadly force to defend yourself when someone's trying to, like, assault you with a vehicle?
Okay.
I could take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Daniel. Okay. We're getting some nodding heads here. I don't know. Go ahead, John.
I think the threshold on that would be, it sounds to me like a situation that would describe that you reasonably believe you're in danger of serious physical injury. So that seems to me that you're in a position where you're going to have, you know, the ability to wrangle with the statute in a meaningful way. Do you disagree with that, Jay?
No, he's describing this. My answer here is kind of the same as the gas pump scenario we heard a minute ago. Someone's trying to run him off the road. That is the use of deadly force. He probably has a claim that he reasonably is afraid of serious physical injury or worse. So as a hyper-technical matter, he's probably got the right to use force and deadly force to defend himself. I hope it would, there's an alternative, and I'd need to know more information mm-hmm. before I gave you a definitive answer on that. You know, how far away are there alternatives? Is it reasonably necessary to use deadly force? And I sure hope it wouldn't come to that.
Mm-hmm. And we're back on the driveway again. Really popular question. What if I attempted to pull the driveway intruder from my car and he resists? How, this is like a trivia game. No, it's not a trivia. It's too important for that. But, you know, it's like scenario twisting. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think it changes the answer in any way, because if a person is resisting, I don't see how you would spin that as they're trying to rob you or commit a robbery.
You have become kind of, you initiated the physical contact.
Yeah, you initiated that. And, you know, you don't, if you're trying to effectuate a citizen's arrest, that's certainly not written into what allows the use of deadly force, is that you were trying to effectuate a citizen's arrest and the person resisted. So I don't think it would change my answer at all in any way.
How about you, James?
This gets really complex because so someone's getting into my car, so then they go out and confront the person, and then
the owner.
Right. Well, yeah. you can use reason. There's a different statute. This gets complex.
Yeah.
So, but there's another statute that says a person can use reasonable non-deadly force to prevent a taking of property. And it gets complex from there. So I don't know if
you can't spin it out, really. Yeah.
And maybe I misinterpreted it. I heard it to mean at the moment when they start resisting my efforts, am I entitled to use deadly force?
That's how
I
read
it. Being asked,
but yeah. I'm going to take one more caller, if we can. Arlo calling from Wasilla, asking about cops and cameras. Maybe that's another whole show. I don't know. What's your question, Arlo?
Hi, thank you. Given that everybody has cell phones with video, how do we best comply with law enforcement officers, but also protect ourselves using video cameras? Like, how can you do both of those? Hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Any response to that?
I'm not sure what the question is. But
I suspect the question is, if I get pulled over and I want to turn on my video camera on my cell phone to record everything the police does, is that acceptable? And I would say, yes, you can do that. I think I've seen some of those roadside videos where the police perceive midway through that they're being videotaped, and it has quite an effect. That's what I heard that question be. I don't hear it to be on online with use of non-deadly force mm-hmm. or deadly force. Mm-hmm. But.
Just make sure the police officer doesn't think you're pulling something on them.
If you're putting your hands in your pockets and pull out your phone,
That's right.
Well, we have just a very short amount of time, maybe for a sentence from each of you or a few sentences. What's the most important thing you want people to leave after listening to this self-defense and stand your ground show? Because that's the reason we had it. We don't want people to misunderstand what the rules are. So, I mean, could you just spin out a little bit for us, John, and then James?
Sure. I think we heard it in one of the questions from a caller about stand your ground implies that somehow if your ego is being intruded upon, you have a right to use deadly force. That is the farthest thing from the truth, and the situations where you can use deadly force uh-huh. are very well defined and very small, frankly.
Yeah, and they will be second-guessed by lots of other people. You hear the music, and so I'm not going to be able to give you a chance, James, to go. Maybe we'll have you back another time. So we are out of time. I'd like to thank our guests, James Fayette, a prosecutor in the Anchorage District Attorney's Office, John Cashin, a former public defender and now in private practice, and, of course, Judge Elaine Andrews, and listeners and callers. They had some questions today. Next Monday is Labor Day, and we're taking a break, so you should too. I'll be back as your host on September 10th. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks for joining us today on Justice Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.